I was wondering, like, what exactly was Yitzchak's plan? I mean, was he just going to give the bracha to Esav and then just leave Yaakov out? I mean, that seems to be the way it would work out.
Yeah. Okay. Good question. Any other questions before you embark on the journey?
Any question?
Yitzchak, how is it that Esav deceived Yitzchak so well?
Esav.
Like, why did Yitzchak think Esav was such a good guy? Like, he couldn't figure it out.
Right.
Yeah, I read an article by that was transcribed from Shir by Revi that said that Yitzchak was just so much of a tzaddik that he didn't really realize, he didn't really recognize the nature of Roshayim, so he was incapable of seeing the fact that Esav wouldn't be able to make use of his bracha in a way to perfect his own, you know, his... Yitzchak thought that Esav would be able to use the bracha to perfect himself, but really he just used it for physicality. That's what he would use it for. But then I thought also that tzaddikim, like, by virtue of the fact that they are tzaddikim and that they perfected themselves, that they should know the natures of Roshayim, you know?
Right,
good point. All
right.
Wanted to set that for starters. Take a look at the system. Can I throw one other question?
I can't hear you. What?
Throw in one more question.
You want to throw out a question?
One more.
Go ahead.
Well, I just understand that Yaakov knew that the brachos would serve better for him than for Esau, right? And maybe if he would have told Yitzchak...
Slow down. Who knew what?
So I understand that Yaakov knew that the brothers would serve him better than they would serve Esau, right? And that if he would have told Yitzchak that, so maybe Yitzchak wouldn't have agreed with him. He wouldn't have seen that Esau was a Rasha. But why does that make it okay to turn around and steal the brachos?
You're asking why he had a right to steal the brachos?
Yeah, to deceive his father. I mean, it's Gemilas Das, for sure. I mean, I understand there's no halacha like that then. But why does that make it right? Not only that, but I would say since Yaakov... since Yitzchak thought that he was blessing Esau, I would say the bracha was going to be batal on Yaakov. Like, it's like, the bracha is like, just like, it's like a money, like currency, like you give it to a person and like, whoever gets it, like he's the one that keeps it and spends it, you know? I'd say it's batal, like you didn't have das for Yaakov.
Okay, that's a good question.
And also... he says that Yaakov maintains that
I think that there are shiurim on that. That question that you're raising, I think Rashi gave shiur on that.
Well, I remember when he gave the shiur about Ola Tamima.
No, I understand that. No, on this particular question, the issue in terms of the worth, the validity of the brachos.
Right. I remember that shiur.
In a case like that, I suggest review that.
Right. Did we do it last year?
He's done it. The truth is, he's visited the area a number of times. He might have given a couple of shiurim on that.
No, we did one last year.
Well, fine. If that's the case, it's probably better in a case like that to make that the starting point. You know, either review this year, either you'll find that that's satisfactory. If you have questions on it, we can proceed from there rather than just starting from scratch. Okay?
Yeah. One more question now.
Yeah.
When he bought the birthright, you know, from Esau with the soup, right? So the Torah seems to like, I think that like there are indications that that Yaakov was saying that it was really his because he bought it with the soup, but like it's not really clear that really did it. Like, did the soup give him the right to do it or not?
Oh, that's two separate things. It would seem that the Bechora was one thing, and that he bought, I mean, he purchased. That doesn't seem to be a matter of deception. Maybe he took advantage of him when he was tired, but too bad. That's one thing. The brachos is a different issue. The brachos At least.
Well, what was the Bechora, though, then? There wasn't a Brachos.
I'm saying the first thing was the Bechora.
What was that?
All right, it's not even clear, I'll tell you the truth. It's not clear what exactly it's referring to. It's different, you know, is it referring to the, sort of the Pishnayim, even though that's before the Torah, in terms of the, you know, inheritance? That is to say, maybe you didn't have specifically a din of Pishnayim, but it would appear that the idea that the Bechor, you know, inherited more, or whatever, that was pretty Matan Torah. It's not clear, or the right to do the Avodah, you know, I'll be honest, it's not clear to me what exactly was the difference, what exactly he was attaining by virtue of the Bechor. As opposed to the Brachos, they're more clear. Brachos, the Torah enunciates, they seem to be all the materialistic aspects, blessings, and so forth. So at least you see what it is. The question is, why was it so important to him to have these material things? But that's, at least the Torah spells it out. The Bechorah, it just says the Bechorah. And it doesn't tell you what practical consequences it had in those times. So, I mean, I've been, you know, like looking up the different sources, and I haven't found anything that really I understand. So I'll just put that in another name. All right, I think we should get back to the basic question. It's a good question. I think if most of the guys go along with it,
which one?
The question that was raised before Yosef about how he was able to fool him. And if you want, unless most, you know, the majority of the guys don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, that's yeah, great.
All right. All right, so let's take a look at Sukkim. Okay.
When you say how was he able to pull him, I mean, the Chumash seems to give shot, doesn't it?
The Chumash gives shot in what?
How he pulled him.
Not that simple. But the question was raised that more than just how he fooled him. But another way of putting it is how could Yitzchak be fooled was the question. Because a tzaddik, it is a good question, at least on the surface, a tzaddik is supposed to be not simplistic or naive, this is the way it appears. That's not our concept of a tzaddik. See, for most other religions, it might not pose such a problem. For say, you have even among today, even among Jews, that have this notion that someone is such a great tzaddik that he really, you know, he thinks highly of everyone. That he couldn't suspect anyone of doing harm. And like he's naive. These people love that notion. They love to feel that there's someone out there that is, you know, such a tzaddik that he just believes everybody does the good. So he believes good about everyone. People like that idea because psychologically, it's appealing to them. That means that they can be approved of also, you know. It's,
what do they do with Vayishlach?
I'm sorry?
Vayishlach.
What?
Parshas Vayishlach?
I know what you're talking about. What
Yaakov and Esau?
So what's your question?
What do they do with that?
What do you
That's the whole situation of the whole parsha. That whole Sefer Maisa is Yaakov saying that Esau is a Rasha and I can't trust the guy at all.
So Esav is a Russia, so what's your problem?
So not everyone is...
No, they like the idea of a tzaddik. And once you identify a tzaddik, that he's the kind of person that is such a tzaddik that he sees good in everyone.
You even see too much good in Esav.
That's his point. It's not a good view of the
tzaddik. Yeah,
we're talking
about
Yitzchak
here.
Esav wasn't a tzaddik. I have no idea what you're talking about. Esav wasn't a tzaddik. Esav was a Russia, so it's a Russia. But the idea... That's some kind of an ideal that they have. That the you see that. Look, I don't. I'm not getting into specifics. Like people have this notion, you know, that the like the Rebbe sees the good and saw the good in everyone, so to speak. You know, people like that. That's a because they want to. You know, they want this unconditional love. People are looking for unconditional love and unconditional acceptance. So, because they don't want conditional, because everybody feels guilty about their own sins. They know that if the love was dependent upon their worthiness, then they might be condemned, not love. So they naturally gravitate towards the Rebbe. He was kindly and loving, and he loves everyone. As though this is a milo. Why is that a milo? Why should you love someone if the person is corrupt, if they're evil? So the question is a good question. The pasuk we read it in the tefillos. I think it's part of Kabbalah Shabbos. Oved Hashem Sinu Ra. Those who love God hate evil. So nobody likes to talk about that. That's a mark of a perfected individual. You can't have it both ways. You can't love everyone. You can't love evil. You love evil, so then you can't be an Oved Hashem. But the Oved Hashem, those who love God, love goodness. They love the truth. They love righteousness. And if you love righteousness, then you must hate evil. That's the way we're constructed. So if that's the case, it's an essential element of the tzaddik that, first of all, that he hates evil, for sure, but also that he's able to know the difference, to differentiate, to define it, to recognize it. So it's a good question that how is he deceived? Okay, as opposed to saying Esav was good at deception, of course. The question is not on Esav. The question is on Yitzchak. Let's go through the Pesukim a little bit. It's interesting. After it describes the whole thing is strange at the beginning, the pregnancy and the effect it had upon her and all of that. And then even the way they came out, the Yodo Chesed Bakel Esav, all this stuff is very fascinating. What does that mean? That his hand was grabbing onto the heel of Esau. Interesting piece of information. What am I supposed to deduce from that? Okay. So we'll begin at Pasuk Chaf Zayin. It says, "Vayigdalu ad ha'arim," that the children grew up. As Rashi points out, that in spite of their natural constitution, you see that constitutionally there was a difference. And Rashi points that out too, that famous Rashi you're all familiar with. That Rashi explains that how he throws to Abban and Bekirba, that the children, so to speak, were contentious, contending within us. Like wrestling. But she had a very difficult, unusual kind of a pregnancy. What they were supposed to do was like running, jumping. So the Rashi, the famous Rashi here, Rashi says that the Chachamim darshened it as an expression of running. Kishahoyisa overes al pisei Torah shel shen v'yever. When she was passing the Eitz Medrash, so to speak, of shen and ever, Yaakov rut. So Yaakov would run and jump to go out. Overes al pisei Akum, when she went by the church, so to speak, the doorway of the church, Esav mafachetes lote. Then Esav would jump. Now that's really a strange Rashi.
Huh? Like they knew where they were.
Yeah, like how do you attribute that? I hope everybody out there, not you fellows, but everybody in the world at large would acknowledge that this is not a chazal that's intended to be taken literally. But who knows? I'm sure that. How do you take that literally?
I believe God can be such a good woman. Man, they believe that it happened exactly like that.
Exactly like that.
Exactly. That's the way it was explained, at least. To me, probably
to everyone. Yeah, but I'll tell you, Rashi contradicts that. Rashi right over here, in my opinion, contradicts that.
Well,
the teacher could have said, "Mamma." Which one are you doing? Take a look at Rashi. Listen carefully. According to this, you have to assume that even as fetuses, they had a fully formed personality. That one was an individual who wanted to pursue knowledge, recognized, and was able to recognize inside the womb when the mother was passing by a Beit Medrash. He jumped to get out. And the other one was wicked, was an idol worshiper. And when they passed by a church, wanted to get out. He's going to take it literally, which is an absolute absurdity. But you're also going to have to assume that they didn't have free will, because it would appear from that that there was a each one was predestined, each one was created. One was created to be a tzaddik, and one was created to be a rasha. That's what you'd have to assume, which is absolutely false. It's contrary to the Torah. There's no such idea. And that is to say that no matter what the Torah describes about Esav or Yaakov, neither one of them was a tzaddik by nature. Each one of them had to exercise their bechira. Now take a look at Rashi on Vayid Luhan Aram, Vayid Esav. That Rav Zion, the Rashi says, he's addressing the issue as to why the pasuk says "Vayigalu." Kolzman shahaya katanim lo hayu nikarim b'maseyim. As long as they were katanim, they weren't recognized in accordance with their deeds. The ain adam medaktek b'hem mativa, and nobody discerns. Nobody is involved in determining their nature. Even as soon as they became 13, that Polish Lobotim and Roshos, that Polish Lobotim. It's completely different. Rashi seems to be saying that when they were 13, this one turned towards the Beit Medrash, the exact same terms he uses in the other Rashi.
It would be an open stira.
It would seem to be an open stira, because according to the first Rashi, it was before, when they were in the womb. This one was Polish in the Beit Medrash, and this one was Polish to the church, Avodah Zarah. Here Rashi is saying, no, as long as they're little, nobody know, you don't know their nature. Even though you see children behave in a certain way, it's obvious that that Esav was different as a child than Yaakov was. But Rashi is saying that as long
why
as they're
obvious,
you don't know what they're like. But anyway, there's a contradiction, right? How do you resolve the contradiction? Like a long story short, it doesn't mean you can't take the Rashi literally. It would indicate not predetermination or predestination, but there's a different word, you gotta be careful how you use it, it's predisposition. Which is to say that everybody is born with different constitutional makeup. The Rambam talks about this. I think he talks about it in other places, but if I'm not mistaken, in the Shmona Prakim. And he goes through this issue about free will. And there's different constitutional makeup. And some people are born with more aggression, with more instinctualism. Other people have less energy in the instinctual, and you know, you can go through all the various emotions or inclinations, and they have all different types. So it could be that a certain person by nature is more in line constitutionally with a certain way of life, but it doesn't matter, because no person, that's not virtue, because there is no nature per se that's good or evil. If a person is extremely humble and unassertive to the extent that he just basically doesn't do anything with his life, he just basically has no ego, he doesn't have no drive, has no desire to succeed, has no ambition. So what do you can say? Perfect? Now, even though ambitiousness, ego is a problem, the drive can be a problem, ambition is a problem. Yeah, it's true. That only means to say, in terms of how it's utilized, and what the end result is. But the disposition per se, in order to achieve any kind of success in life, a person has to have these factors. If he has no energy, he has no drive, he has no ambitions, he'll sit around and do nothing, and what's he going to achieve?
Yeah, but right, man?
A person can't be defined as good or evil in accordance with their natural disposition, yes?
If you say that, so the Rashi seems to be, I mean, whether it's literal or not, okay, so it's not, but it seems to be clearly attributing that the disposition was specifically towards good and evil. Because one was the Pisrei Shem Be'Eber, right? The Be'Eber Shem Be'Eber, and one was the Avodah Zarah. So that's the first question I would ask. And the second one is, it's just a predisposition, so then why, you know, they both made Bechira decisions, so why is Rashi telling us this at all? You know, what's the Chazal? The Chazal has no meaning then.
Who said it has no meaning? One second. What do you mean it has no meaning? It's making a very profound point.
Oh, okay.
Making the point.
My mistake.
It's making a very profound point, if it's understood properly. And that is that the two of them had completely different dispositions. Totally different dispositions. Now, it's a good question, though. See, it's easier. I think I see what you're getting at. Because the way they describe it, it seems to be too specific. That is to say, if it's mentioned that the one was naturally more instinctual, that's one thing. But I think what you're asking is that it's connecting him to a specific of Avodah Zarah.
Right.
How does the person have an instinct towards Avodah Zarah? That's already a particular. To say that Yaakov was even in the fetus, was naturally drawn towards Chachma, the idea itself doesn't make sense. Because a fetus can't be drawn towards Chachma, or even a child is not drawn towards Chachma. Forget about fetus and talk about a two-year-old. You're not going to say there's a two-year-old when the mother with the carriage goes by the Beis HaMedrash, the child jumps. Even that would sound absurd, because a child of two has no desire for the Chachma. But I would say like this, it means to say that the attraction towards Chachma as a way of life is rooted in a certain type of a personality. You see that for certain people, they're more naturally drawn towards the intellectual. It's a natural phenomenon, which has to do with many things. That is to say that it's two factors. First of all, their inclination or their desire for the material things, for the instinctual things, is really not that powerful. Basically, I would say, I'm not going to go too far into the psychology. We can revisit this at another time. Which, you know, I'm not interested in analyzing this, breaking it down that much. But you see, children in general have a lot of intellectual curiosity. That's natural. It's just that as the child develops, for a number of reasons, they sort of lose a lot of children lose the enjoyment of learning. A, it's not cultivated sufficiently, and, you know, basically in terms of the school system and everything, so they're turned off. And they associate learning with pain rather than with pleasure. That's one of the factors. And also the power of the other instinctual forces. If the other instincts in a child are very powerful, then the child is running after the instinctual, the aggressive, playing ball and indulging and having fun. So that takes over the entire personality, and then learning is looked upon as a big pain. So I would say that in terms of the natural disposition of Yaakov, it was in line with that was his nature. That is, he didn't have a pull, he didn't have a strong pull towards the instinctual. So he naturally gravitated towards the intellectual, which is going to be the case. You have that kind of a personality who has a terrific mind, and like an Einstein type, even as a child. I mean, he starts curious, he starts asking questions, and he has a tremendous mind, and he's not diverted, and he's enabled to satisfy it. I guess anyone that was raised in that house, in that environment, was able to satisfy their intellectual curiosity, that they were given good answers and so forth. So I would say that in terms of the disposition, given the absence of the negatives, the egotistical and the ambition and the instinctual, and also the tremendous mind that he had, so that was by nature. I think that's what the Chazal is saying, that he was sort of designed by nature to gravitate towards the Beis Medrash. It was very much in line with his nature. That's what it means. It doesn't mean to say that he actually physically jumped. It's depicting it. That's the way the Chazal expressed it. It depicts it in that way, graphically. As though, if he could move, that's what he would do. To tell you what to draw, that there was a very strong inclination in that area. That's all it means. From the womb. But that itself is not perfection. That itself is not a perfected person. That a person is just by nature a thinker and just lose that kind of a life, that's not what Judaism... I mean, it's an advantage, let's face it. It's certainly an advantage. But in and of itself, it doesn't constitute... life is too complicated. It doesn't constitute what we would consider perfection. Now, in terms of Esav, it becomes a little bit more difficult because they're saying towards Avodah Zarah, not towards lust, or, you know, you might choose a different metaphor. If it was when she passed by a house of prostitution, it could have used that metaphor. But it doesn't. It says towards Avodah Zarah. So that's more challenging. I think that's what Yosef was asking. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the answer?
The answer is that because a lot of these things can be subsumed in the category of Avodah Zarah. Because the basic idea of Avodah Zarah is that a person will the emotions are so powerful in the person that they blind the person towards reality. Like, that's the basic question of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah really is kola, like a lot of other, most sins stem from a certain an idolatrous desire in the person, you know, to put their emotions above reality. So,
good point. No, I agree. Yeah. It's a very good insight. You see the usefulness of these chazal. It's a very good insight into the underlying framework of what leads a person to Avodah Zarah. And Avodah Zarah doesn't mean that the Oved Avodah Zarah doesn't want to have a God. Everybody wants to have a God. But it means to say that if a person is governed by their instinctual, the instinctual is the determining factor, then that puts them in a position of opposition, of conflict with an objective reality, an objective truth. So they can't accept the God of truth, of reality, because it goes contrary to their instinctual desires. Because then they are going to fall into a different idea of God. That's why it says the Sartem, if you turn away from the Talmud Torah, you worship other gods. There's no in between. It is to say that then your idea of God will be patterned in accordance with your instinctual desires. That's Avodah Zarah. Not that it'll be an atheist. Very few people are atheists. But that's Avodah Zarah. That's what it means, that there's a lust. By the way, there is a lust for that. That's also a lust. Because that's part of a person's desire. Not just to gratify all of their tithes, all of their instinctual desires. That's also an instinctual desire to have a being, to project a certain being that you can believe loves you and takes care of you and protects you and enables you to do all the things that you want to do and not to have any guilt about it. So that means to say that the constitutional elements are beneath the surface, which would lead a person towards the Avodah Zarah, were incipient. So each one of them has their own challenges. Had their own challenges in life. That's why Rashi says later on that confirms that it wasn't a matter that they were predestined. There's no predestination. It just means two different types of constitutional makeup. And you see very clearly that Esav could have been a tzaddik. Because, the question, how did Yitzchak be fooled? But Yitzchak didn't have the notion. Yitzchak didn't have the notion that he was inevitably a Rasha. He thought he was a tzaddik.
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. All right. So now let's see if we go a little bit further. That's what Rashi means. That as long as they were children, which means to say, before, you can't judge a person when the person is in as a child. But essentially, they're instinctual beings, no matter who they are. It's a matter of instinct. It's not until the power of Bechira comes into effect. So roughly speaking, we associate that with Bar Mitzvah. That's what Rashi means. When they become a gadol, so now they assume responsibility, and now they have the ability to take cognizance of their own nature and to contend with their own nature, and to deal with themselves, and to begin to work on their personality and to define themselves. But when a person's a child, he doesn't define himself; he's just a product. So now let's see what happens over here, and see if we can gain an understanding. Sukkim are very interesting. Yigdalu on Aaron. Now is when it becomes significant. Vayi Esav, Ish Yodei Asayid, Yisada. And Esav was a person who knew how to hunt, a man of the field. Yaakov Ish Am, and Yaakov was a wholesome, I guess, Tam. Something that, Tamim means like sort of perfect, without a blemish.
even the
king. Olam, yes? Yeah. Yosheva Olam. Someone who dwells in tents. Now, what does that mean, someone who dwells in tents? Is this to be taken literally? How do you interpret that? I mean, just plain pshat. What's the plain pshat over here? He dwells in tents.
He sits and learns, like he kind of doesn't need the outside world so much.
Just give me the plain interpretation.
More of a passive person?
No. You're not getting what I'm saying. Okay. How do you translate that? How would you translate it?
A homebody.
A mama's boy. Well, we don't know if he's a mama's boy or not. I mean,
don't you see the problem? You got to develop sensitivity to the wording. Don't you see the problem? Look at the whole process.
Yoshi is bit of a
contrast between the way they're describing Esav and the way they're describing Yaakov, and it becomes a big problem.
Should it upset each all of them?
Doesn't say your day off, Yaakov.
Again, I'm asking you, how would you translate this? If you were writing a translation, would you translate it that abiding in tents? Does that make any sense? We're not talking about where they live. Well, where did Esav live? What did he live in? Houses, and he lived in tents? Aren't we describing what they did? Isn't that the point?
Yeah. He took care of the household.
There's a tremendous contrast over here between the description of Esav. In the description of Esav, we're not interested in what kind of housing he had. We're interested in what he did. So it tells you, he's a man of the field. He knew how to hunt. Now it's going to tell you the contrast. What about Yaakov? What did he do?
Yaakov stayed inside.
He didn't do very much.
Yaakov is dumb. He was a wholehearted person. Yosheva Olam, he lived in tents. Who cares where he lived?
He didn't do very much.
I'm sorry?
He didn't do very much.
No, he took care of the stuff at home. He took care of watching the flock.
He didn't do anything. He sat home and did nothing. Yosheva Olam, he sat home and did nothing.
You aren't.
He sat in the tent. How do you know he learned?
Well, yeah. That's what he was doing in the tent.
How do you know that? Is that the plain shot or is that a midrash?
Rashi
says that. Take a look at Rashi.
If
you never read Rashi, I think this is crazy.
I don't think so. I would say that he's passive. I would say that he learned.
Esau hangs out outside. He's in the field. He's chilling out there. Yaakov just like coming around. He's mostly in the tent.
I want to know if the plain shot is that he lives in tents. That's it. Now, the Midrash, take a look at Rashi. Well, what Yosef is saying is correct. Yoshev Oholim, Rashi says, well, it's plural. Aholo shel shem is interesting. Plural. Sure, by the way, if it's just telling us, should say he lived in a tent, if he stayed home in his house, it should have simply said that he stayed home in his tent. Oholim, so Rashi says, Aholo shel shem, the Aholo shel Eber. So that's correct. What Yosef is saying is correct. It's telling you what he did. He didn't just sit in a tent, because that's not doing anything. It's telling you that he learned. But I want to know if that's the plain shot or that's a midrash. Because you have many midrashim, but there's an aim shame mikra Yosef midrash pshuto. What would you say?
Well, I would say that at least a plain shot is that some people have a desire to make an impact in the world.
No. You don't understand. You're explaining it to me. You're explaining. I want to know the plain shot. Translate. Tell me what the pasuk is saying. You'd be quiet. I'm not interested in explanations. Why it's saying? I know that that's correct.
I watch the TV.
They stayed home and took care of the household stuff, like watching the flock and doing, you know, like.
Is that the simple pshat?
Simple pshat. Is that he stayed home and took care of the house?
No,
abortion.
Okay. Without Mepharshim, I think you just say.
I want to know, excuse me for interrupting, I want to know if Yosef Olam, Olale Torah, so to speak, the tent of Torah, it is the plain shot, or it's not the plain shot, it's something which is alluded to.
It seems like it's not the plain shot.
Take a look at the Unculus. Unculus is a good barometer on these things.
No, it's different.
Yaakov Gvar Slim, Shamesh Beit Ulfana. Ulfana. It means that Yaakov was a defective man. Shalem? Interesting. But Tamim is Shalem. Shalem is whole, defective. One who Shamesh, but lies himself in a house of study. Beit Ulfana is a house of study. So that's how he translates it. In other words, not that the flame shot is Ohalim, but the deeper allusion is to Beit Medrash. No, he's saying that's the flame shot. I think that the reason, it makes sense to me. I'm not, I don't mean to say that it has to make sense to me. I'm just saying, I think I understand. You have to learn that way, because otherwise, what's the point? The point is to tell you where he dwelled in tents. That would make sense if you're talking about a situation where there's different types of housing situations. You have, even today, you have the Bedouins, they live in tents. So you're describing something about them if they dwell in tents, because most people live in cities or whatever. But it doesn't make sense to say that in this pasuk we're trying to describe where he lived. I assume that everybody lived in tents in that time. Or if everybody didn't live in tents, then they lived in houses. I mean, who cares what he lives in? So therefore, given the nature of the pasuk, that the pasuk over here is telling us about the character of these people, what they did, so that Yoshev Ohala means, it's plural, is that he dwells in, it's a reference to a certain kind of tent. It has to be a reference to a certain kind of a tent of Torah. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. That's why the uncle is translated that way. Not that it's a midrash. It's the pshat. That's the pshat. That's what I wanted to point out. Okay? Now, it just has to be that way. Otherwise, the pasuk is really telling you nothing about Yaakov.
I mean, I don't buy that. How is that? Why can't Yoshev Olamim just mean he stayed inside? Esav went outside, this guy stayed inside.
But that doesn't make any sense. Nobody just stays inside. Why do you stay inside? Why don't you go outside?
To get your personality. They're outgoing people.
Then you're saying it's not literal. It's alluding to something.
So
what's
it
alluding to? He stayed inside, he went outside. What kind of a thing is that?
What kind of descriptions Yoshev Halim to mean that he stayed inside and learned? Why not say he learned?
Because Ohel is a reference to Torah. The Ohel Torah.
Which is a bigger stretch from the words of the Pesukim?
No, it's the difference what the biggest stretch is. It's not a stretch. You have to understand it in terms of the context. Since the term Ohel can refer to Ohel, Ohel can mean two things. Ohel can mean the generic Ohel, or Ohel can mean a specific type of Ohel. An Ohel of Shem and Aver. Okay? How do you know which one it is? You have to decide by the context. What kind of information the Pasuk is trying to convey. If it's trying to convey to you what type of housing he had, so that's one thing. Then you would say it's generic. But who cares about the generic oil in this sense? It doesn't make any sense. It's a pasuk without Unculus, which we'd have a problem. What's it telling us? Nothing. So then you'd have to say, it's telling us that he learned. Other than that's what it's telling us. It's not a hint. When you have a hint, like most of these midrashim, you have the flame shot. You have the flame shot, then it's alluding. It's alluding to something. It says, for example, it says by, that Avraham on the road, that he mentioned the Sarah. Now I know what a beautiful woman you are. So basically the flame shot is that now is the time to be concerned about it. Not that he didn't know before that she was a beautiful woman, but they have midrashim that until now he didn't even notice that she was beautiful. The midrash. Which tells you about the character of their relationship. But it wasn't of any significance to him, and so on and so forth. But you have the flame shot. Flame shot is that of course he knew that he was married to a beautiful woman, but it wasn't an issue until now because they're going to Mitzrayim and he has to be concerned about it. But you have the flame shot. As I'm saying, over here, it's very difficult to just translate it, that he sat intent, which is saying nothing. And if you don't come up with your explanation that he was learning, it's meaningless. So then you have to say that's the pshat. Otherwise, you're saying that the pshat is meaningless. You can't have something which is meaningless as the pshat. Now, with unkelos, it's not, because that's what it means. That's how the Torah is communicating to you that he sat and learned. That was his occupation, sitting in tents. Sitting in tents was his occupation. Now, why couldn't sitting in tents be an occupation? There's got to be a tent of Torah. Where that tent is, people do things in a tent. People, that's the activity.
Okay?
All right, now, what happens next? All right, so basically, this is not telling you anything disparaging. It doesn't seem there's anything disparaging about Esau. Two different types. One was a man of the field, and one was a man of tents. He was a scholar. Then it says, by Yaav Yitzchak as Esau, he sighed the fifth. And Yitzchak loved Esau because the sighed was in his mouth. That is to say, flame shot, here you have to differentiate between the flame shot. Here's the case where you have the flame shot and you have the midrash. The flame shot is that he fed his father the food. That's the tie of the fib. The fib shall Yitzchak. I believe Rashi says that. Let's take a look.
Yeah.
The fib. Take a look at it. Rashi, Kitargumo, the fib shall Yitzchak. Again, the Tirgum. He in the mouth of Yitzchak. Said Rasha, but the Medrash is the fib shall Esav. That the Sayyid was in the mouth of Esav. It's amazing. You see the difference between Pshat and Midrash? And there's no problem. The Pshat means there's two completely different ideas. One is that it's the mouth of Yitzchak. The other one is that it's the mouth of Esav, and there's no problem. Yeah, there is no problem, because one is the pshat, but the Torah alludes to many, many ideas. So there's two ideas over here. One idea is the fifth shal Yitzchak. Who made Rasha, but fifth shal Esav. But the Medrash is, and that's true too, that he hunts in the mouth of Esav, that he was a hunter, not just a hunter of animals with the expertise and the bow and the hunting and all of that, but Shoyatzadoso, that he was a great hunter with his mouth. Umarameyu, he was deceiving Bidvara with words. The Medrash is giving you an insight into, a deeper insight into the character of Esav. So, of course, what was the hunt? How did he hunt his father with that? Take a look at Rashi above, Yodea Tzayid. Rashi expands on this idea. Yodea Tzayid, that he knew hunt, is a reference, of course, to both hunting. Now that we've established in the Medrash that there were two kinds of hunting. There was the physical hunting, trapping the animal, but that same instinct, that same underlying ability, apparently also was expressed in a difference. He was able to understand. See, a hunter has to study the prey. An intelligent hunter will study the prey and is able to sense the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities of the prey and to exploit them. I mean, it's in animals that hunt, it's an instinct. In hunters, in human hunters, they have a certain amount of instinct for it. And they learn. They study the weaknesses, to exploit the weaknesses of others. Now, Esav developed that to a greater extent than exploiting the weaknesses of people, and even his own father. It's interesting, he worked on two levels. According to this, he worked on two levels. But the Sayyid Befim, Shal Yitzchak, the fact that he fed him his fine food, that's also part of the deceit, because that was the emotional. Everybody, even you see from this, by the way, I just wanted to make another point. In general, I was thinking about this before you guys called, that Yitzchak over here in this parsha, Yitzchak made a serious mistake, because you see, he himself, when he discovered it, by Yechavad Charad Gadolah, and he trembled, a great trembling. This wasn't a minor mistake. This was a very serious mistake. And the situation was saved essentially by Rivka. An important lesson over here. But this is just a side note. I just thought of it that this is so completely different than the contemporary attitude towards Gadolim. You know, in the contemporary biographies and so forth, always it's like they present, they portray the Gadolim as being like saints, that they always knew it. The idea is to have insight into everything, and even as children they knew, and that they could never ever make a mistake. The idea that a Gadol, someone that they look up to in this manner, can actually make a mistake is missing. You don't have that idea. You're not even allowed to suggest it. Whatever they did was right. But here you see that's not the case. You saw that the Torah doesn't present it that way, because you're talking not just about a tzaddik, you're talking about one of the greatest individuals that ever lived, and a Navi, and all of that, and the Torah is depicting they made a mistake. So we don't have any such concept. But the way he operated Esav was on the emotional level. And everybody has emotions. Look, you have a child. He presented the idea of being an individual, even though his natural pull was not towards learning, so what? But he was a man of the field. But he's someone whose ideals were correct, that he utilized his abilities in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you see that he kibbut av, that he practiced kibbut av to a tremendous extent, to a tremendous level. And he was able to create an emotional impression on Yitzchak. Yeah, he went out whenever he would go out hunting, so he would bring back the best and prepare. You see, later on he tells him, prepare tasty food like I like. So you see the Esav knew that the Esav was extremely pleasing to him. So that creates a certain emotional disposition towards a person. And that was, you see, that was one aspect of it, but that would not be enough in and of itself, because that's not what Yitzchak values. Yitzchak is not going to value a person simply because they provide him with food. But, you see, that was sort of like to prepare the ground. Someone who wants to win people over works on two levels. One level you work on is the emotional in general. And by serving a person, by providing them with gratifications and so on and so forth, you're sort of preparing the way. And so now they have a positive emotional feeling towards you. But that's not enough, because then it's a question of their value. The real key of getting the approval of someone is to appeal to them on the level of their value. You see? So that's the level of their... Look, it's not going to be the same. There could be someone in the town that is a baker or whatever. He has a restaurant, and he always goes to the rub of the town. He brings him nice rolls, this and that. So that's going to create a certain emotional fondness. But he's not going to identify with him, because he's not a Talmud Chacham. He's a nice guy, but he's a baker. You see, Esav went beyond that. Esav wanted to prove to him that he was extremely loyal to the law, to the way of life, to the ideals that the Torah as it existed at that time. That's what he says. Yodei Atzai is Lossud, Ularamos as others Vesiv. That's where the mouse came in, the Shoalo. And he would ask him, Abba Hech Ma'asri as Amela. How do you give Meister on salt, the Esatevin, and straw? Kasavar Aviv, Shehu, Medak Tekri Mitzvot. So his father thought that he's very meticulous about mitzvot. So what exactly was he trying to do over here, Esav? He was trying to create an impression that it's true. You could ask, if that's the case, so why didn't he abandon the hunt, and why didn't he sit and learn the Beit Midrash and all of that? No, that wasn't his nature. He couldn't do that. Well, first of all, you have to understand that even a person who's a great hunter, who's a great deceiver, but it's impossible to go to that extent, because your own nature is going to come out. Moreover, it wasn't necessary, because you see, he recognized that the philosophy of Yitzchak was not that everybody is the only way to serve God is by just sitting in the tent. That there are different ways to serve God. The idea that Yad doesn't include the concept of going out in the field, of seeking Olam, of building up the world, of being productive, and all of that, that's part of the idea of, yeah, that's an ideal. As long as it's being done, L'shem Shemayim, that a person is utilizing his talents and his abilities to serve God. Not everybody is a Talmud Chacham that sits and learns the whole day. So what Esav was trying to do was to win the love of his father. Take a look at the Pesukim over here. It says, Vayav Yitzchak et Esav, Yitzchak the fifth. That Yitzchak loved Esav because of the Tzayit. So he was convinced, he had a certain understanding, a take about this Tzayit, that it was a righteous type of an endeavor. The Rivka Ohevet et Yaakov. And Rivka loved Yaakov. So now, it's interesting. It doesn't tell you about the attitude of Yitzchak to Yaakov. What about Yaakov? Nor does it tell you about the attitude of Rivka to Esav. How would you answer that? It's missing something. It would seem that the pasuk wants to communicate the attitude of the parents to the children. So it tells you that Yitzchak loved Esav. Does that mean that he didn't love Yaakov? It also tells you that Rivka loved Yaakov. What does that mean? Does that tell you that she hated Esav? What are you supposed to infer from that?
That there's like a basic love for a child, and then there's like an additional love?
See, so saying one thing. Which one are you explaining? Yitzchak to Yaakov?
Give me a general explanation for both.
Okay.
That there is a basic love for a child, but it's not talking about that. It's talking about a case when a parent really loves the child, much more than the basic amount. Or is it saying that Rivka loved Yaakov much more than Esav, and Yitzchak loved Esav much more than Yaakov? It's a comparative thing.
Yeah, but to me, that's a little bit bothersome. Now, you may be right. Of course, we don't really have any information, specific information, other than our own logical deductions. Is that what bothers me is, okay, so he loved him, but what about loving Yaakov? Yaakov was in his time, Yosef Ohalim. I mean, wouldn't Yitzchak love that? it's nice. It's nice to say that he also loved Esav. What do you mean? What's not to like? What didn't he like about Yaakov? I'll tell you what I think, but as I said, this is a bit of speculation because I don't have the specific information. But this is how I read the Pesukim. But it's important, you see, to break the Pesukim down this way. I would say that the pasuk, you see, by Yitzchak, it's telling you the chiddush. See, it's no chiddush to tell you that Yitzchak loved Yaakov. I don't read it. But Rivka Ohevet et Yaakov. That Rivka loved Yaakov means to say that she's the one of the Yaakov as opposed to Yitzchak. Yitzchak did not. That would be very hard to say. Why would he love him? He was a son, and B, he was a tzaddik. He was living and learning. Why wouldn't he love him? It doesn't make any sense. But it means to say that the chiddush, each one, of course Yitzchak loved Yaakov. That's no chiddush. But it's telling you the chiddush by Yitzchak is that he not only did he love Yaakov, but that he loved Esav. That's the chiddush. Because Esav was a question. Esav was, you see, Yaakov was not a question. Yaakov was sitting and learning. His son, who was a tzaddik, he sat and learned. Of course you loved him. But the other person was a hunter. So what you take? Is he for real? Is he a tzaddik? That's not so obvious. Whether he's a tzaddik or whether he's not a tzaddik. So it's saying the Yitzchak Ohevet. That Yitzchak loved him. Yitzchak regarded him as a tzaddik. And whether he loved him more or not is hard to say. I don't want to get involved in that. But you see, you have to understand that if Yitzchak was correct, Yitzchak's assessment of Esav was that he was a great person. A great person. Because it's one thing, as we said, a lot of people are by nature predisposed towards learning. All right, so they sit and learn. So who would you say is a greater tzaddik? Someone that by nature is disposed towards learning, he sits and learns. Another person who by nature has all these challenges his energy, and he can be tremendous success and do whatever he wants to do, and he utilizes all of that. He conquers the Yetzer Hara and uses all of his talents in the service of God. You might say that he's a greater person. He's deserving of more admiration, because the other person doesn't have these inclinations. So he's much more in line with his natural constitution. But someone who is a great, let's face it, today, in today's society, someone who's a tremendous businessman, and he could be anything he wants to be. And he could take over corporations and go into politics and be a ruler and so on and so forth, and he utilizes all of that to serve God. That, you could say, is a tremendous, is a greater person. Okay, now I'm not saying I can't go into the particularities, but you can see that the attitude towards Esau, whether you love him or not, depends upon your sense of what the real person really is. And since Yitzchak was deceived, so Vayev, he loved him. That's why the Pasuk has to point it out. I'm not saying he loved him more or not. There's no doubt in my mind that of course he loved Yaakov. That's not a chiddush. So when it says Verivka Ohevet is Yaakov, it means to say she only loved Yaakov. Her love was directed only towards Yaakov, because Yaakov, she recognized, was the real thing. But Esav, it doesn't say that she hated him, it just says she didn't love him. Which means that she was suspicious. She was suspicious of Esav, but Yitzchak was not.
Wouldn't that have been inferred if they had left out the part that Rivka loved? Rivka loved Yaakov, because we said the reason it...
No, what's it going to say? But it told you, this is the perfect way to say it. The Rivka, however, that's all she loved.
Right, but we said that everybody assumed everybody loved Yaakov. It's a chiddush.
No, I'm trying to tell you. No, but that, I understand that. But once I told you that Yitzchak loved Yaakov, we infer that he loved Yaakov, but the fact is he loved Esav as well, so then I have to go back to Rivka and say, well, she didn't love. How does it say she did? How does it say that she didn't love Esav? The pasuk doesn't want to say she didn't love him. The pasuk is saying, you see, the pasuk is saying that she loved him, meaning only him. That's how the pasuk is doing it. You see, that's how it's communicating that information. Okay, so let's see if we can understand how he was deceived. Yodea Tzayed, how do you guys understand that? The whole key over here is, you know, Yodea Tzayed, Tzayed the Fifth. Ellis?
Yeah.
All right, let me hear. Let's get the. Now we're in a position to answer the question we started with. I mean, you guys are sort of suggesting that it's a bit of a defect that a person is a tzaddik, he's supposed to be able to recognize the Rasha.
Well, the point is he should, but he could be fooled. It's not impossible. Everyone can be fooled.
But it seems like a low level of like fooling, like giving him food and then that all of a sudden deludes him into...
It's not the point. The point of that Rashi is to say that it wasn't just food. That his whole life was set up in such a way to convince Yitzchak that he was really a big tzaddik, and I guess apparently like the superego was so strong, he had like such a desire to satisfy that superego emotion that he really directed like as much of his energy as he could into creating a whole facade. You know, which basically took his like basic inclinations and then directed them not towards truth, but towards something which looks just like the truth.
So you're basically saying that a tzaddik normally is able to know the nature of Russia and the fact that Russia lies. But if Russia is a really good liar, then he pulls a tzaddik.
What are you saying? That a tzaddik can only...
I'm not saying. That's what I'm not
through.
Saying.
Well, exactly. That's all true. In other words, everyone can be fooled.
Yeah.
There's no one out there who can't be fooled. So the point is, Esav was a tremendous, was a high level of fooling. Esav really dedicated his life to this,
right.
And he was able to pull it off.
Right.
And the fact that someone like that was able to pull it off is something which shows us, you know, the level of deceit that was involved. But that just, you know, but that's just a rishus. That just shows us the level of rishus. You know, that doesn't mean that there's anything which is impossible or even far-fetched about that.
In other words, not showing a flaw in Yitzchak, it's showing something, the fact that Esau was so good at being deceitful, right?
I think there's more than that. I agree. There's one thing you could add to that, though. You could say that we know it is possible to become perfected in one area or one mitzvah, and clearly Esav was a role model in terms of just the mitzvah of Kibbud Av, right? So it's not just that Esav was appealing to Yitzchak by just giving him food or by creating. He did create a whole facade, but it was centered around his perfection in this one mitzvah. And that is something that Yitzchak can appreciate. It's not just that he was appealing to him on the level of food, but he was appealing to him, like putting forth the fact that he was perfected in this one area. And so that, you know, that's a stronger deception.
Let me interrupt, guys. Bear in mind also that I hear what you're trying to do, and it makes a lot of sense. You're going to try and explain why it's possible. But if that's the case, then you're going to have to explain also, well, where's the case where it's a defect? Where the failure to recognize, I mean, you can always rationalize. When a person doesn't recognize the Russia, you know, you could always say he's been deceived.
Not every Russian perfects himself in a certain area, especially in an area that's this.
I don't think it was just this one area. It was that his desire to be in line with what his father would want didn't just make him do kibbud av ha'ein, but he really conducted himself in his life in such a way to make himself look like a tzaddik. Because it wasn't just kibbud av ha'ein. He actually would, I'm sure when he was around his father, it seems like everything he would do, you know, would be directed towards trying to convince his father that he's really a tzaddik.
Yosef is correct. I mean, it's not that simplistic either, that he would, that everything was just a total fraud and a deception. Take a look at the Rashi, and you know, when he sold him the bechorah for the lentils. Okay, so Rashi says adushim adumos, they were red lentils. That's Rashi. It's mina adam or adam. The Rashi learns. Listen, kids, very interesting. Yoso Hayom Meis Avraham. That this event took place, this was like a meal of condolence, Sudas Avra. And that was the day that Avraham died. Shlo Yira as Esav Ben Beno, that he should not see his grandson, Esav Yotei L'Tarbas Ra, to go out to Tarbas Ra, to a bad life. Apparently, Esav was a tzaddik. The angels save a tova, because it said, "I shall kill Hashem's baruch." God promised him that he would die in a goodly old age. But if that was the case, that he had to witness a grandson as a rasha, that wouldn't have been a goodly old age. L'fichach katar Hashem's baruch hey yomim mishnosa. Therefore, God cut off 5 years of his life. Interesting. See, we would look at that as being a terrible thing to lose a few years of your life, but no. The contrary, that sometimes it's a benefit, that you don't, there's no point in just adding more years. If the years are going to be painful and harmful, so then you're better off dying earlier. Interesting idea. Yitzchak lived 180 years, and Avram lived 175 years. Yibisha Yaakov Adashim, and Yaakov cooked lentils, Lahavros, as Avel, for the Sudas Avra, of the mourner. Alright, and then he says, why Adashim? Because it's like a galgal, it's like something circular. That's because Avel keeps, the process of life and death. One second. Alright. Alva. Where does Rashi say? Rashi says that on that day, the day that Avram died. That was at that day, because he was Ayyaf. Where's Rashi? Who Ayyaf? Oh, one second. I think it's on Hine. Yes. Hine Anochi Holech Roma. So Rashi Amami Bey. Yeah. So Rashi learns that the Bechorah, by the way, was the right, because later on, the Avodah was turned over to the Kohanim. But originally, it was intended for the Bechor. So it was the right to do the Avodah. Okay. I'm not sure. Where is Rashi? Are you referring to Rashi that says that on that day he violated all the averos? Who are you? Rashi. But who are you? For Ticha. Amar de Tema. He was Aye with killing. He was involved in the Ticha. Give me a second. It's brought down in the Torah Tumimah. Ayavo Esav min Asada. On the Pasuk Chavtas. Ayavo Esav min Asada v'hu Ayei. So in the Torah Tumimah. It's brought down. Ayavo Esav Tanya. Kol zman shehaya Avram chai. As long as Avram was alive, lo marad Esav. Esav didn't rebel. Yosef, Ayavo Esav min Asada. By Vitanya, also Ayom, Nifter Avram Avino, on that day he died. The Amar, also Russia, Chomesh Averis Beyomahu. Okay? He was over on five Averis. Then another statement of Rav Yochan, Chomesh Averis Omah. He violated five sins on that day. Nara Hamurasa, Haragat HaNefesh, Kavav Tchias HaMesim, Kavav Ikar, etc. And he rebuked the Bechora. Okay, whatever it is, I'm not interested in these particulars, but this indicates, bear in mind that if you calculate the years, the ages, then it turns out that they were 15 when Avram died. You do the calculation. So according to this Chazal, the death of Avram apparently had a very strong impact upon Esau. But all I'm trying to show from this is that you see that it wasn't just only a matter of deception. That was part of it, but he was struggling to keep the system. He was struggling. He was involved in a struggle. And apparently the influence of Avram was extremely significant, and the death of Avram had an impact upon him. We could discuss that at another time.
Rebbe?
Yeah.
Isn't there a chazal? I've been looking for it. I can't find it. But at the end of the parsha, where he says that Esav married Mahlas, Shemimchalu Kolavonazav,
so?
That he did, in other words, that he did tshuva.
Yeah. Of course, yeah, again.
So the point is that he's a complex person.
He was a complex person.
I mean,
we should not look at it simplistically.
But I couldn't find the chazal, I just couldn't find it this time.
Which one? Okay, fine. From the one I just quoted, you see that he was really struggling. So therefore, it's not so cautious. Now, let me just, see if I can summarize what the idea is. It is true. It is true that it's a defect in a tzaddik if he can't identify rishus. No question about that. But there's a difference. For example, you see that there are many, many Rishayim in our century, throughout all of history, that are able to deceive people. I mean, the person doesn't have the capacity to be a Tzayid, the fifth, to be a hunter. No, the only Rishayim that are successful are those who are masters at the art of deception. If they don't have that's why the intelligent ones are the most dangerous ones. Hitler, Yimach Shemo, he deceived the entire world. And Arafat and all the other Rishayim in this century were able to do their evil because they were able to deceive people. So that is a big, big defect that when you study the pattern of a Russia who's involved in his rishas, of course he covers it up and he says it's only because he's fighting for his national liberation and he's really the victim and they impose the settlement on him and all of that. when you study the activities of the Russia, you must be able to identify it as vicious, and you can't be taken in by the rationalization. That's a serious, serious defect. And that's the Israel is suffering to a tremendous extent today because they gave into this nonsense, the whole Oslo, and they deceived themselves in spite of all of the actions, the overt actions, which demonstrate nothing but wickedness and vicious and a desire to eradicate Israel. They were able to buy the rationalizations, and they brought tremendous harm upon themselves. That's a very, very serious defect. However, this is not the case over here. This is a different phenomenon which can happen because he didn't really see the evil of Esav. There were two factors at play over here. One is the nature of the tzaddik of Yitzchak. He had a particular type of a personality, as we said, Olo Kamima, which meant to say that he was really not the kind of a person. He was withdrawn from the world. That's why he couldn't even go to Chutz La'aretz, and that he was more of a metaphysical personality. Now, that means to say that he lived in the world of the abstract truth. And in terms of dealing with, I mean, dealt with people, he had to deal with people. But he didn't have that intuitive psychological makeup where he could really see through the subtleties, the hidden types of things. Of a person who's really overtly doing everything correctly and has targeted you. And he's perfect. That is to say, this happens in many, many places in yeshivas where you'll have a Talmud who is really adept. He knows how to work the Rebbe. Because the Rebbe has no reason to suspect him, and he could be, you know, wasting his time the whole time. Then as soon as he comes in, he runs over to him with a very sharp type of a question, and that question indicates, gives the impression that he's been involved up all night thinking about it. So by doing that, you create a certain impression in the mind of the person, the Rebbe, and he has no reason to suspect you.
Can we say, is it possible to say what emotion it was that blinded
Yitzchak? Sorry? What?
Is it possible to say what emotion it was that blinded Yitzchak?
I'm not going to get into emotion. I'm telling you, you don't even have to. It's not just that. It's not just the emotion. It is the nature of the personality that doesn't lend itself. Not everybody has every kishron. There's a certain kishron.
Well, it's because of an emotion, and if you were completely intellectual,
I'm not saying that. I am not saying that. I'm not saying that it was. I'm saying that that's sometimes the nature of the person. There are certain people that have an insight into certain areas. Certain people have an insight. They can look at a structure, and they can sense certain things about the structure. Other people can't. I'm looking at it more that way. That's not looking at it as an emotional defect. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it comes about because of certain factors. And that was his nature. His nature lent itself. That's why he was such a hunter, Esav. His nature lent itself to being vulnerable to a certain type of deception. We don't assume that everybody's perfect in every way, in every area. It doesn't mean it's an emotional defect. That's what I'm trying to say. And therefore, it happened. But Rivka had a different makeup. Rivka was extremely intuitive, was extremely insightful. I mean, women in general are much more adept in this area. You see, even the case of Sarah and Avram. Avram had much greater insight into people. Avram had much greater insight into psychological makeup. He had to analyze his own self to free himself, you see, to free himself from all the idolatrous emotions. Yitzchak was a different type altogether. So you can't use those types of terms. Therefore, I'm saying that over here, it's not a defect. It's not a defect, and it's also showing you that the Ashkacha involved, that the Avos, that despite the fact that this was his greatness, and his greatness was that he was completely involved in the metaphysical. Well, that's the case. So he didn't have that type of an approach in terms of the practical. But it wasn't an overt mistake. Like he someone was a Russia, is acting like a Russia, and he thought he was a tzaddik. That's not the case. This is a completely different type of a case. That would be a defect. Here it's not a defect. But the Ashkacha provided him with Rivka, that Rivka was able to see. And Rivka had to work out a way in which to compensate for this inability to see. All right, I'm losing my voice, though. Okay, I think we'll stop here.
Thank you.
I gave you plenty to think about.
Shabbos.
Shabbos, guys.